could start that. I'm Wayne Price, and a member of the Northeastern Federation of Baptist Communities of NEPAC. This is Daniel Cull. Daniel Cull from the Anarchist Federation of Britain. This is Eric Horn, who is a, works at the General Desire Army. And we're just going to talk for about 15 minutes. And that'll give us 45 minutes for you all to participate in the discussion as well as ourselves at cross-discussion. Originally, this was planned to be a workshop called Anarchism 101, Introduction to Anarchism. It's been sort of morphed into Aspirations for Anarchism, Anarchist Aspirations. And we're not entirely sure what that means, but we're going to be expressing our opinions and giving the basic concepts of we see anarchism. Since we come from different tendencies within anarchism, it should make it kind of lively and interesting, we hope, as we have a friendly, but perhaps divergent views. Okay, I'm going to go first. Let's see, what was I going to say? My point of view, I'm speaking for myself, and I'm speaking for my organization, NEPAC. But I think we are generally in the mainstream of anarchist tradition. How much that's true and whether that's worth it is something that you have to decide. The first thing I want to say is that fundamental to anarchism is a sense of vision. And not accidentally, we have a workshop called Just the Visions of Anarchism tomorrow. Unlike Marxism, which sees sort of the goal of communism as sort of, well, that's just what's going to happen. And therefore, you should be for it. You know, you can read through volumes and volumes of Marx and Engels, and I have, without ever finding a statement, socialism is good. This is why you should be for socialism. It's just not there. It doesn't mean they weren't personally motivated by great senses of injustice and so forth. It just wasn't part of their conception. Because anarchism starts from a conception of a vision of a different kind of society, a good society, which doesn't contradict the feeling that it's now possible there are certain factors that lead us to make it possible, to make the society case possible, and that there are forces pushing in that direction. But socialism is not inevitable. And it's anarchism is not inevitable. And this is something you have to make a commitment to or don't make a commitment to. It's a matter of choice, of individuals and choice of mass and people. We're choosing to look towards a different kind of community, a different way of human beings relating to each other, a different kind of society. Key aspects of that society include radical democracy. A lot of anarchists don't like to use the term democracy partly because they associate it with the frauds of bourgeois democracy, the limited democracy that we live under. And others don't like it because they associate it with tyranny and majority. But the basic concept of self-management is really something just about all anarchists agree with, whatever you call it. And really I call it radical democracy. The key aspect is not so much to make it more democratic for the people who you send to some far-off place to be political for us, is what representative democracy is, but to make democracy part of our daily life, for people to meet together in a face-to-face community, assemblies and committees on the shop floor, in the factory, or workplace, in an office or whatever, in the community, in the neighborhood, and decide what they're going to do that day, what they're going to do that month, what they're going to do indefinitely. It's something that democracy becomes a living force, which means an end of the state. The state is not just a question of really coordination or whatever. The point of the state is you have a special body of bureaucracy, of hierarchy, of armed people, the police and the military specialize in violence, of politicians and lobbyists, and officials, judiciary, professional lawyers, and all these people are set up as bureaucracy that stands up socially alienated to the rest of society, a machine that stands over above us. We want to do away with that, and I think we can do away with that. Which doesn't mean that there isn't going to be coordination, or that there isn't, through our practical council dimension, federation and association of different popular councils and committees. Then there will even be, at least for a time, I would imagine, some kind of defense against, say, foreign armies of counter-revolutionary forces. That would be the armed people, a popular militia or guerrilla forces or something, rather than a concept of a specialized military that stands over and above the rest of society. For those who saw the leaf that I did about, half the people in the room, Kropotkin says pretty much the same thing. It's a decentralized society in order to make it possible for people to meet in committees and assemblies and so forth, which means a different kind of economy. An economy that's run for cooperation rather than competition. That's run with production for use rather than for profit. With conscious decision making that is democratic, some kind of bottom-up democratic planning rather than domination by the market. That is the talking about what we call libertarian socialism, or sometimes libertarian communism. I'm not going to argue with it, maybe. It's anarchism is at the far left end of socialism and socialist tradition. Not because we advocate, well, we are bitter opponents of all varieties of state socialism and state communism. We are advocates, we are complete opponents of capitalism in favor of some kind of cooperative democratic society. Let me also mention that anarchism takes a position on the structure of the environment, the ecology. We are faced with various threats, and this should be clear. We don't believe that anarchist socialism, is something that would be good, would be better than what we have. Anarchist socialism is something we need. For without it, the human species is threatened with destruction, as well as other species on this planet, either by nuclear war. There are more bombs, and spreading more bombs since the end of the Cold War, nor during the height of the Cold War, and less control. Sooner or later, if we do not get rid of these nation states, they will be used. And similarly, it's been the destruction of the ecology, the environment, the energy, whatever you want to call it. A whole series of crises based on the capitalist drive to dominate the environment, to make profit. There are those who simply accept the technology as it is, what we call technophiles. The position of the Marxists and the liberals. Well, let's tinker a little bit, maybe stop the nuclear energy, have more regulations or something. And then there are those who want to reject all types of technology. John Zerzan and his group of primitives are perhaps most famous. So I want to go back to the hunter-gatherer level of society. We believe in a third perspective, namely that technology can be used in a way that is consistent with a cooperative, decentralized, and democratic society. This means that the first thing after a revolution, one of the first things we'd be doing, would be immediately to try to start to reorganize the technology, the way production is done, the way the world is organized. To immediately do away with the distinction, for example, in production between those who give orders and those who take orders. To immediately do away with things that cause pollution, destruction, and violence. These would be immediate tasks to end the poverty throughout the world. Let's see, only a few more minutes. Major question would be how to get there. And one of the major distinctions in the anarchist movement is what we call the debate between reform or revolution. While among the liberals and the social democrats, and even most Stalinists, their main perspective in our society is that they'll gradually run candidates and they'll get elected and perhaps take over the Democratic Party and gradually take over society and peacefully change it into a different kind of better society. Or the perspective of Marxists, Leninists, and other countries, or nationalists, is they will overthrow the existing state and set up a new state, which will be their state. We reject both perspectives. On the other hand, there are reformist anarchists whose perspective is not that they're going to build a new state, but rather they will build small-scale cooperatives and organizations and alternative institutions which will gradually spread peacefully and sort of swamp the state with capitalist institutions. I don't see that. The state is very powerful. Corporations are very powerful. The possibility of local shops gradually overcoming general steel industry in this country, the auto industry, or swamping the state is just not possible. Whenever the state realized there was such a danger, they would step on it. There is an alternative. You have to fight right now for all kinds of limited struggles. I'm not against that. Nor am I against the cooperative. I live in a cooperative housing apartment, for example. A nice place. It is no threat to capitalism. I think that's a good thing. It's about your overall strategy. My overall strategy is to build movements right now that will struggle against the existing system and which will ultimately, not today, not tomorrow, not maybe in the immediate future, but will aim for an ultimate revolution and overthrow and smashing the existing state. The last point I want to pick up on, and again, very briefly, I'm saying these things, of course, very briefly, given our 15 minutes, we'll always speak in a very condensed kind of fashion. So if you feel that I'm being very simplistic, you're quite right. I don't have much time to give it, elaborate. So maybe to the point we'll discuss it in a later session. The last point is, who's going to make this revolution? Who's going to make the transformation to society? I remember being in a meeting many years ago, with a group of left-wing organizations, Trotsky's groups, and somebody said, it's a shame that the capitalists, the rulers, they run our society, we need to change, we need people like people in this room run society. And no, it's not the people in this room, even our people. It's the mass of people who take over and run society. Our job is to be part of that struggle. But it's ordinary working people who are something like 80% of the population. We're going to have to take over society. It's ordinary women, it's ordinary, it's the most oppressed sectors in our society, black people, people who are oppressed by their sexuality, people of color. These are the people who are going to change society. We particularly look towards the working class, that is the same people as workers, because as workers we have a particular power. Workers can stop the whole thing in its tracks. The whole society can stop working. Workers can start it up again in a different way. And nobody else can really do that. It's not that workers are better than any other oppressed group, that workers are better than deaf people, for example, or more oppressed. I'm not arguing that. It just is a particular power. At the same time, it's a mistake to say only workers can make the revolution. We need everybody. It's like, I think of the revolution sometimes as there's piles of dynamite. There's a big pile of dynamite at the working class or other specially oppressed groups, let's say women. It's a big group. And then there are little piles of dynamite, smaller people like gay people or prisoners. And we need all the dynamite there is to blow the system up. Everybody who's got a grievance should be part with us. Because all these systems of oppression intersect with each other, interlock with each other, support each other. Yet capitalism is sort of central, I would say, because that's why we live without clothing and we eat and we work and spend most of our days. And our income depending on that, but it's not the whole shebang. It's the whole thing. They're all supporting each other. It would be impossible, speaking of liberation of women, to say the working class can make a revolution and have a society where women still be oppressed. Half the population, half the working class continue to be oppressed under socialism? It's absurd. What a concept. Even if anything could magically happen like that, the workers would lose power. You can't maintain oppression. You can't maintain liberation. Unless you had all oppression of everybody. So our perspective has to be to fight against all oppression in every area to make an overall free society. And now I've reached the limit of my time. And,
Alright, so good afternoon. I'm here representing the Anarchist Federation of Britain and the International of Anarchist Federations, which is an international federation of groups from various countries, mostly in Europe, also in Argentina, and there's quite a few groups in Eastern Europe particularly. So, Wayne's talked a lot about what is and isn't anarchism, so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we, the AF and Britain, actually do, and what it actually means from our ideas. So, the AF is a national federation of small anarchist groups within England, Wales, and Scotland, and until very recently, Ireland as well. Although the Irish groups are now big enough to form their own federation. So, the way we organise is through anarchism. Everyone pays a national dues to the national organisation and becomes a member of the main organisation. And from there, people form small affinity groups, which then network locally to form a regional or citywide federation group. And over the course of the year, the various groups meet and discuss national policies and national issues that we want to work on. And for the rest of the year, as well as working on those sort of issues, the local groups are completely locally autonomous to do what they want and how they want to do it. Because the Anarchist Federation is not a platforms organisation, it doesn't have a set of agreements that the way you have to operate. We have 10 agreements that we operate by that everyone has to agree to actually become a member. They have to agree to that and to be active within the Federation. But other than that, the thrust after that is, as long as you agree to these things, we can have a variance of opinions, and there is a large variance of opinions on nearly every issue within the Federation itself. So, a little bit about the history of the Anarchist Federation. We were formed as quite a few bridge groups were in the aftermath of the miners' strike in 84-85. We formed out of a history of being very small platformist groups who were actively trying to bring towards an anarchist agreed permanent organisation of anarchists that would be structured and organised and work together. Unfortunately, quite a few of them became too platformist and ended up being Leninists and Trotskyists. But those ideas carried on through, and at the same time lots of Marxist groups were falling apart, and there was lots of theoretical discussion groups coming out, such as Solidarity and Wildcat. And they came up with lots of interesting ideas. And there's a particular pattern for it, which is continually reprinted, called Outside and Against the Unions. And that formed a basis of our union policy, which in the Anarchist Federation is we are against unions, all forms of unions, including syndicalist unions, as structures towards the revolution. So these ideas have carried on. They also had another idea which formed theoretically from the miners' strike itself. These ideas were that anarchists and working class people can act undemocratically, essentially. They can act beyond and over the democratic agreements of a strike. And this was in terms of the miners' strike was actions such as the hit squads who would go around attacking scout vans, attacking the police, and preventing the strike, people trying to scout the strike. And there are also other examples with the flying pickets, which are completely illegal and now completely illegal. These ideas fed into our union policy as well. So we have a union policy of workers' resistance groups, which is small autonomous groups based in different industries, acting as they wish to act, outside and against unions, or within the unions. We don't have a strict policy on union membership itself. Another big historic influence on the Anarchist Federation was the poll tax, or the anti-poll tax movement, which actually started in Scotland. The organisational structure of this was local small groups, again federated nationally, so it was very anarchist in its outline from day one. The victories of the poll tax movement came down essentially to non-payment of poll tax, non-payment of fines, and holding up court cases in the most ridiculous manner people could think of. Coupled with direct action and occupations of buildings, etc., and then obviously the big riots that happened, not only in London but all over the country. So these sort of local small groups, most of them actually died out after the protests, but there's a few that carried on. And these sort of groups have been a big influence in the current policies of the Anarchist Federation. And we're actively trying to build lots and lots of small groups, not necessarily federated to the Anarchist Federation at all. We'll help in any way we can to build local groups around local issues. And this is a big policy at the moment. Another big group that we've been heavily involved in this is the Haringey Solidarity Group, which I'm also a member of. This is the one group that has lasted since the poll tax times. We continue to be involved in various issues, but the big issue in the UK at the moment for local groups is the anti-IB actions. It's a trying to introduce a national IB system, which will bring you towards all these different databases, such as medical databases, police record databases, e-library databases. This will all be conglomerated into one massive database, which will come through one ID, which the police will have access to everyone's records, and they're already being allowed through spot tests and checks and fingerprint IDs and all this Irish scan on the street without arresting them. And this is a big issue in the UK, which the AF has taken a major lead in trying to prevent. And this is really, we're slowly growing, and hopefully we'll hear more from that. Other big issues in recent times, obviously, has been the anti-capitalist movement, which obviously hit big here with the Seattle protests. But prior to that in the UK, it comes from the movement came together in 1994 when they introduced the Criminal Justice Act, which essentially attacked anyone who was different. So it attacked squatters, hunts, abs, the free party scene particularly. One particular thing is they banned the listening to amplified music of repetitive beats where there was more than 12 people present. And that could get a 5-year prison sentence for doing this. So obviously that brought a hell of a lot of people around the country together. And that fed into ideas where the Reclaim the Streets idea came from, just a mass resistance to that movement. And these sort of ideas were coming together of all these small groups, coming together into these national networks. And large numbers of anarchists, including the Anarchist Federation, came together to try and influence that in an anarchist manner. And that eventually came into the anti-capitalist movement and the massive riots that we saw at J18 in London. Interestingly, for the British anti-capitalist movement, 1999 was essentially the high point, and ever since then it's been a downhill cascade, which is slowly falling apart, the whole movement. And since then, secondary issues such as housing have become a huge issue again in the UK. And we now have a social centre network, which is often critiqued for being lifestyleists and other things like this. But there are large numbers of class struggle anarchists involved in these, and some of them have been very effective in bringing local communities together around a small space where they're free to do what they like, how they like to do it, and to discuss politics in the open, which a lot of people have never done before. And for that reason, these have been extremely good spaces. In some instances, the community spaces, as they became, were defended not by anarchists, but by local people, and local people fought the police off without the anarchists even being involved, which has been hugely inspiring for a lot of us in London and elsewhere around the country. So in this time of the sort of the burgeoning anti-capitalist movement, the Anarchist Federation also went through a period of internationalisation, where we joined the International of Anarchist Federations, which was actually established in 1968 in a conference of various organisations, particularly the French and Spanish, the Italians, who helped found that system. Since we've been a part of that organisation, we've tried to push internationalisation of the anarchist movement. And it's been really nice to see other organisations that have the same opinion, such as Earth First, who've been hugely influential in internationalising these sort of issues. So in terms of what we actually do in ITLA, which I think is becoming more and more important, we try to do lots of speaking tours where we get lots of anarchists from different parts of the world to come and tour Britain and tell people what's actually happening in their local communities. So we've had people from Eastern Europe, we have people from Argentina, one of the big uprisings we've had on there. And we've had people from Australia and from all over Europe as well. So these sort of speaking tours and building up links have been really, really good for the anarchist movement in Britain. Other things we do, particularly for organisations like Antifa, is there's a massive fascism problem still in Britain and in the rest of Europe. And there's a growing Antifa movement which is getting stronger and stronger. And to give you lots of benefits and lots of contacts with these subgroups and try to help as much as we can in that sort of thing. So, and another interesting project, and if anyone wants to donate money to the aid for this project, we'd be more than happy for it, is to organise printing presses for South American anarchists. Basically want to print as many pamphlets and issues as they can all over South America, and we're trying to raise money and help with the expertise for these same issues as well. Of course, the anti-capitalist movement has been helpful in terms of our internationalisation, because we've attended and helped organise summits and anti-G8 summits, and the IFA have been particularly involved in sort of Evian and also the G8 in Britain. The big sort of time killer for what we do in the AF and what we use most of our time is still writing propaganda and distributing propaganda. So we write a theoretical magazine which is, to be honest, mostly sold amongst anarchists, and it's a discussion forum for anarchists. And it's written not only by AF members, but members of various other federations, groups around the country. But we also have a small free sheet that we give out, which we've got small copies of on the desk upstairs called Resistance. We give this out on street corners, in bookshops, outside tube stations, whatever. We give out thousands of these a month, and people are actually now asking for it when they're around, so it's encouraging them also. It's less a lot of stuff than I can see what it is.
Excellent.
Last speaker.
Hello. Hey, does it work or not? It works. I think that one of the things I'm going to try very hard not to do is to respond to the two other presenters. The thing that is probably important to understand is that while anarchism may seem like a one-dimensional political perspective, if you're not well acquainted with it, anarchists come from many, many different perspectives, and actually, I come from a pretty different perspective than I used to do, and so I want to talk a little bit about it. I want to honor the context of this discussion, which is to talk about aspirations and to give a bit of a 101. And so I'm going to start with a little bit of a 101, and I'm going to talk about aspirations at the end, because it will be very scandalous, and then we can go from there. So to talk about it 101, and I'm going to give one of the things that, of course, is true in any political perspective is that there is a lot of jargon, a lot of acronyms, a lot of slang that you'll hear used. So I'm going to give a term that probably will be new to most of the people, and it will be a term that I'll fill in through the course of talking about a 101. But it serves as a good line of demarcation. So I'm going to talk about something called second wave anarchy. So second wave anarchy starts with a historical question. In other words, it essentially says that history from the time of the French Revolution, late 18th century, to the fall of the Soviet Union represents an epoch. And it basically, as anarchists who were one of the political consequences of the French Revolution, says that anarchists' response to the fall of the Soviet Union should be clear. In other words, it should not be this is just another day like the days before, but should see the fall of the Soviet Union as something extremely important. Important enough that I'll call, for the context of this, 101, that a second-wave anarchist position, by and large, reframes the conversation about revolution as one that has not been answered. In other words, the French Revolution was so reactive to the fall of the Soviet Union was a period when we could have believed that leftist revolution was possible. By and large, anarchists who come from what I'm calling a second wave anarchist position no longer believe that that is true. It may be possible, but it's not true. Another distinction or something that's important to say about second wave anarchists, by and large, second wave anarchists have been inspired by a group from France in the 60s. Called the Situationists International. And the Situationists gave extremely harsh criticisms of anarchists. And most anarchists who have come since then and have been influenced by those situations have taken those criticisms to heart. Many of those criticisms are about anarchist analysis of social struggles, are about anarchist conceptions of revolution, and obviously about using the term anarchist. In other words, is it actually appropriate to label everything that we do with the A word? To talk about the question or the time period between the French Revolution and the Soviet Union, the reason that I'll continue to refer to is because, by and large, opening up questions rather than declaring them as answered is extremely important for position. And in the case of revolution, anarchists who come from more of a classic perspective, because they are striving for something called revolution, tend to focus all of their time and energy on that one practice. And sometimes that what it is that they're doing is useful and interesting besides from the fact that it fails a revolution. But other times it just seems like irrelevant. So the politics of the vast numbers of different political tendencies that falls within the second wave anarchist generality actually kind of spreads at the end. Within the North American context, many of the groups who would derisively be called the right stylists, most of them fall under the general rubric of second wave anarchists, but so do many so-called insurrectionary anarchists, green anarchists, individualists, and more. Many of what I would call incoherent anarchists, who seem to be into free love and the IWW, and their past lunch organizer, all of these people tend to actually come from a perspective where they're as inspired by the situations, for instance, as they are by the Kunin. So, this line of demarcation and why it's relevant to continue the heart is because for a second wave anarchist, by and large, their interests have been very, very diverse. In other words, without the primary focus on transforming society, there are a variety of different ways in which anarchists decide to spend their time. So I'll talk a little bit about aspirations. For me personally, when Wayne talked about the aspirations of his anarcho-communist society, while I wouldn't use almost any of the terms that he uses, I actually agree with almost everything that he says. And so, in most anarchist arguments, and in most political arguments, you tend to find that if you peel away the layers of the rhetoric and the bullshit, you actually find that there are not a lot of similarities. Separate from the people who call themselves anarchists who are capitalists, generally speaking, all anarchists, whether they are of one tendency or another, tend to agree that our project is the total transformation of society into a stateless and classless society. I tend to agree with that. But it's not what I do with my day-to-day life. And for very few anarchists that I know, including the ones who talk about it all the time, it's not what they do with their lives either. Personally, I'll try to make a couple of pop culture references to patch some of what we've gotten to the ground. I was deeply affected and continue to be deeply affected by this movie, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, that came out in the 70s. And the reason why is because very early in the movie there was a scene where they opened this very, very large door. And when they opened this large door, they entered this room that in all its technicolored glory represents everything that me as a 6-year-old child desired. And the idea of this world being created probably by adults, or being crafted and all the rest, or by an adult who wrote the novel. But the idea of this moment and the feeling that I had in that dark room, seeing that door open, that world shown to me, that's the feeling that I have when I think about what living in anarchy would be like. And I desire that world.
and I desire the impulse and the feeling that I have when that door opens. And I don't have to wait until after the revolution to have those feelings. More importantly, I can be part of crafting those rooms to other people that I know, to individuals, in group situations. And remembering that imagination is actually a primary value for anarchists is, I think, something that separates at least my aspirations from any other anarchists that I know. But to list other aspirations that I think are relevant, and Wayne actually mentioned it once, but for me, I want to emphasize the point that for me, as an anarchist principle, the discussion about decentralization is paramount. And why I use the word, or why it is paramount, is because I think one of my biggest grievances with the world as it stands is that it is a world that defines society in North America or in the United States by 300 million people. I don't actually think that something that I understand as a society can be that large. As a matter of fact, I think that something that I would understand as a society, something that I live in, that I can understand myself within the context of, and not feel lost throughout the entirety of my life, has to be of a human size. You know, what's a human size? That's a question for me today. But the discussion about what the scale of society is, to me, far more important than what does it look like for us to kick down doors without us. Although, and I also at least want to list, you know, what I generally refer to as the ancient principles of anarchism as ones that I continue to find important and useful. And these are the three solidarity, as in solidarity with other anarchists. Mutual aid, as in support of other anarchists and anarchist projects, and even other people. And direct action. And direct action is not actually something that I see as related as much to activism as I see as related to how it is that we interact with ourselves and our daily lives. So, for instance, a case of direct action is someone put up a sign next to my table, and I had not put up anything next to my table because I feared for pasting things on the wall and the administration going big upset. And so I hadn't put anything up there until I got a chance to talk to someone about it. And I said to the person that they were hanging up the poster, I will take direct action when I find that it's okay to hang up things while the hand over what it is that put up. So that, to me, that would be an example of how in my daily life I would interact with each other, with other people, with the world, with direct action. So that's all I want to say right now, and look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, rather than my responding, let's take questions from people here. Comments, questions, anything, but you have only 3 minutes to say them. So please don't tell us about when we go to Fourth International. We'll have to do it in 3 minutes. Okay, first. Yes.
Okay, well, here's the pitch to that.
I have to speak loud.
First the pitch. It's really something about the last few speakers were talking about tonight, and I was benefiting it over in Queens, because hopefully we'll be able to hear a repetitive piece of your deep New York store. Stories of electronic music, and it's more about what you said to talk to people about that tonight. I'm kind of getting this way. Basically, all right. So that's going on tonight. I'll talk about it then. So my experience has been more what you call second wave, or even, you know, maybe more focused on spiritual, biological focuses of that we have to transform ourselves, and it's possible, and it's directly possible with practices of that sort, like contribution work or other things, you know. And that's where we're at. And that's why I would say that the right goes back to 1984, when in England at first and now America with the terrorism and the terrorism initiative, the threat was against actual biological transformation. That's a whole lot of delve stuff into, talk about that later offline, but I think on a day-to-day practical level, what we need to do in New York is protect the opportunity to have that here and tonight, to meet face-to-face. We're losing that, we need to protect that, have rain laws, a whole number of things, the surveillance technologies, IP checks, et cetera, are creating fear and preventing people from coming together. So it's really a practical day-to-day thing that we do to help you do that.
Thank you. Next, I'm going to encourage Julie to speak, other people. Yes.
Hi, this is
Stand up, please.
So my question is more for Gary. If you could expand more on where the anti-human stands come from, where, because if you say you could not struggle, unions can be some manifestation of self-organization or the working class. So I just, I'm not too familiar with the stance.
Yes.
Well, first of all, just for the first comment, actually, in terms of what you said, is absolutely correct. The biggest threat to the state in 1994 was not anarchists, it was not activists, it was nothing like that. The biggest threat was people coming together outside of the legal, outside of accepted society, and acting as they wanted to, how they wanted to, such as partying, such as giving up paying rent and living on the road. These sort of things were a major threat to the system, and that's what the government set down. And in doing so, they also attacked anyone in a political stance that was different. In terms of the second question, our union stance comes from experience more than anything else, from various people who've been involved in union politics and also other working class politics for numerous years. And our opinion is that while it's about to be in the union and while it can help you in the short term, it can't bring about massive social change. And it's because the union by its very definition represents the people rather than the people representing themselves. And this is why, and we believe the same is true for syndicalist union as it is for any other union. And so our actions come possibly also from what Aaron was saying, is from people acting as they want to act together, forming new societies, doing the work. People spend most of their lives at work. And so people acting together to make their lives better where they are, in their own particular ways, in maybe not organized, it may not be a threat to anyone, but these kind of workplace, what we call workplace resistance groups, these are that's where our union position stands. And it is a very good position, because there are people within the unions, and I've been embarrassed with the union. But what we don't think about the union is it's a route to social change. It can help in the short term, is what we believe, but it can't bring about social change, which is why, as a federation, we don't see it as a major problem.
One
comment. Just for those of you who want further reading, they are taking that somewhat Brintonian perspective. Yeah?
Yes.
Just a follow-up question. Like I know that a lot of people in the academic hearings are getting involved with the IWW in Britain, which at least my understanding being a member of North America falls probably in the simplest framework. And how does the AF reconcile their involvement in a group like the IWW with an anti-union stance that includes its unions?
Well, it's not an anti-union stance as such. It's just we don't think outside and against. We are influenced by the outside and against. But it's fine to be in the union, and as I said, in the short term, in long term, it may or may not bring about. But we just don't believe it will. The majority of us don't believe it will. And there are people joining the IWW, because the IWW in the UK is located in a few small locations. And for that purpose, it's a good networking system for IWs. So this is one of the big reasons a lot of people in there enjoy, because it gives them an opportunity to be involved on our campus, but quite often they'd be on their own. And it's never good to be on your own campus, but it's also good to be able to have people discuss ideas. But it's one of the main reasons.
Yes.
Hi, this is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
I'm
going to
ask a question about the opposite. It's the opposite.
Is the opposition to the union to the hierarchy that is inherent in the union, or something else? Sorry.
That's a substantial question. One of the main points in the union. But a union in itself isn't about hierarchy. Acts in a hierarchical manner. And that is the status of the places. We don't believe this group is
I want to add, from the perspective of my organization, which is the NEFAC, the Northeastern Federation of Baptist Counties, we would agree with the general statement that the union is not a road to revolutionary change. But we disagree with the statement that you made about we're against unions. That is, the union is only limited to have a certain role of protecting people under capitalism. God knows I would have been fired from my job several times by my administrators if I hadn't been protected by my union, which is not one of the best unions in the world. But we think it's a useful framework. That it's useful to be inside it. And you have to, in a way, the AF can fudge it a little bit, saying, you know, we're against unions, but we're also the working side, because in a country most people are in unions, most workers. In the United States, the union movement is now down almost nothing. Right? In the private sector, it's something like, what, 7%? By now, a teeny fraction. So there's a very real question, are you for the organizing unions? Are you for building new unions in most of the workplace in this country? And I say I am. We believe we are. And not because we think that the unions themselves result, you know, in this automatic step-by-step process into a revolutionary government or something else. But because it's one way in which working people separate themselves out from bosses, turn themselves against the bosses, and organize themselves. And that should go hand in hand with opposition to the union bureaucracy, to the reformists who dominate the unions, the hierarchy, to the demand to make unions as militant and as democratic as possible. That's the way we see it. I'm very happy to have a discussion with the AAF comrade and see what they're trying in their country. And it's interesting to see how this thing's working out.
I'm going to add one more hand, just from the outside and against perspective, which would be that many anarchists would argue that the project of an anarchist is not to be against illegitimate authority, but is to be against authority. And that the desire for an anarchist society is not for a society with a more democratic facade or a more democratic representation or model, but is the one without representation at all.
Yes, please stand up.
My question is basically, anarchism is supposed to be like a federation of different peoples or different groups coming together for a common cause, right? But if that's going against the centralized power, since centralized powers are always more powerful than decentralized powers, wouldn't they automatically lose in any like front against each other? Give me an example. Europe is sort of like a centralized, centralized continent, basically, where other continents are not centralized. That's why they're the most powerful with the European Union. They did that. They came together because of trade, basically. And other countries and other continents have not done that. That's why Europe is on top. Other countries are not. Yeah, whatever. I want that to be, you know, answered. And another one is, what is the difference between saying you're a communist, not a communist, but an anarchist, and being an anarchist? Because when I see most people who claim to be anarchists aren't really anarchists at all. It's just sort of like a front, sort of like a chic front that's, you know, nowadays, you know, you just get the dreads in your hair and like a little shake of our shirt, all of a sudden you're an anarchist. So I want to know, like, what's the deal with that? And why is it like in anarchist groups I only see nothing but whites and there's no other groups of people involved in it? And I think that it is much more than just them not wanting to join. It must be a certain reason that they saw that they didn't want to join or something like that.
Excellent question. Does anyone want to respond? Yes.
Stand up, please. Yeah. Not so much theoretically, but more practically, is that part of the reason, obviously, why more people of various that are attacked in our society more generally, people ask where I'm at. If you know it's here, you know more people are stopped by the police here, obviously, right? Quick fact, before the convention, in November, before that, here in New York, Atticus people of color organized a house party, essentially, in Brooklyn. Went to that early on, left. It was attacked by the police and set up the attack. That's why a lot of people in America don't get involved with things, because they're not easily targeted in a more systematic way. I think that's part of the practical answer. But on a positive note, it may take a while, it may not be the most horrible way to get here, but resisting on certain levels does have an effect. So they were able to win against the city for that action. They took the city to court. They did win to some degree. As it should be pointed out, in Seattle, where I was for the NGO, they just won a court case where they expanded on the police to some degree there, based on what happened when they suppressed people there at the NGO.
I'm going to move a few shots to answer some of these questions. All right, first on a general statement, is decentralized power always able to win over decentralized power? The answer is sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. The historical example you gave is not quite true. Europe was decentralized, broken up into a number of countries, and yet they were able to beat, for example, the imperialists were able to take over China, which was a much more centralized place, and so was India. I don't doubt that Africa is more decentralized than the European continent, which is divided, let's say, from other countries. The other point is, even right now, we follow the news, we see that the United States is having a great deal of trouble conquering resistance in Iraq. Now, without giving any political support to the conservative or reactionary leadership of the Iraqi resistance, the fact that it's fairly decentralized, it's hard for them to get hold of a leadership, that they blend so well into the environment, it's in fact very difficult for the United States, to the centralized great power, to beat a decentralized force. The history of guerrilla struggle shows that not always, but in the right circumstances, a more decentralized guerrilla-like force can beat a more centralized power. Second question you raised about being an anarchist. Well, part of that goes into the whole lifestyle issue. Let's just say there are many people who, yes, accept, like the idea of anarchism, see it as an attractive kind of thing, but stop at the sort of a level of sort of a posture or something. And that doesn't upset me, unlike those of Red Murray Bookchin. It's not something to me to think is a terrible thing. I'd rather be surrounded by people who think anarchism is sort of all right than those who think that, say, we're thrilled with Che Guevara, or various forms of Stalin. But it's typical in any movement, there's a division between the hards and the softs, between those who are committed to making a change, the total transformation of society, as Aragorn said, and those who are not that so committed, but would like to see it be something sort of different. And that's not surprising. I think there should be more people. Part of it is a political difference. If you listen to my statements and Aragorn's statements, my belief that once you make revolution a central perspective, that while living a better way of life yourself is a good thing to do, like for that, I try to be as nonviolent and communal as I can in my personal life, it's not sufficient to prevent worldwide nuclear war or the total destruction of the environment, which is what we're facing. That nothing short of a revolution and smashing the power states will do. That's my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. But first wave or second wave, I believe that. I don't believe these states will ever step down. I don't think these ruling classes will ever give up because they decided, well, that's what the people want and be nicer. Right. Last point about the whites. What's exciting to me, you're right, the movement is mostly white, as the country is, but proportionally, we have a lot more people of color. What's exciting to me is that there has been some influence into the communities of color, both in this country and on a world scale. I get on the internet, I get the Anarchy Africa list from anarchist groups throughout Africa, as well as get groups from Korea and the Philippines and Iraq and Iran, and certainly spread throughout Latin America. There are a lot of anarchist groups in major countries, much more significant than anybody in this country. It's exciting to me the growth of anarchism among oppressed people, and though I agree we have done far from enough to achieve that. No comments.
I feel like I need to be a counterpoint, just so that you remember that there are different perspectives to most of these questions.
Of course.
I'm very interested in the first part of the question that you asked, because it's a question about strategy. And I think that, for me, my own interest is very much aligned with talking about strategy. When we think about conflict, if we were to name the conflict between anarchists and the state, there's almost no way that you could talk about it that doesn't look like an immediate extinguishing of anarchists. And the 20th century has demonstrated that, if you get too rowdy, they're just going to throw you on the boat and ship you somewhere else. There really isn't any place to ship you nowadays. Oh, I guess Cuba. And so I think that question about strategy is really important, and I don't think it's answerable. Meaning that, there's much more thinking and acting to do to even come close to talking about this. I mean, the Rank Corporation, might have been the Rank Corporation, wrote this fascinating thing called Network, that it actually argued the opposite point that you made, which is that the rise of decentralized networks they see as actually one of the greatest threats to kind of their power regime. And I think that those questions that are raised in Network and that have been raised since then are really interesting. I think an awful lot about the Orange Nets, right? And I live in Berkeley, California, but I think a lot about the Orange Nets that were used to surround the bicyclists at the RNC. I think an awful lot about what that looks like as a strategy to stop decentralized networks. And to me, that's where I would start to get those sort of conversations. It's like, what are the easy ways to stop decentralized groups? And then, what are the easy ways decentralized groups can respond? I just want to say one last thing, which is that you can directly track the white faces in the room. In this room, to the relationship that the growth of anarchism in the last 40 years in North America has to the growth of countercultures, and then talk about the extent to which people of color have been connected to the growth of countercultures. And I think that the story is really, they're identical stories. And as you see more people of color in North America get connected to countercultures, you see more people of color connected to things like anarchism. And that story, I think, is yet to be really written the way that I'm thinking it's developing.
Okay, first, the woman over here.
Yes, I had a question. And you have to pardon me because I'm new to this theory. But my question is this. If the way did move to the fact that there was a lot more of local collaboration and, say, the federal government was a lot less powerful than it is now, and this did evolve in the United States, my question would be one of protection. If the whole world was not at that level, then what is the vision on how countries that moved in this direction would be protected from, not having centralized, military or whatever?
Anybody want to respond to that? All right, I'll just say something then. Actually, I said this, but of course it's in passing, so it's hard to focus. Our general conception would be some kind of popular militia, an armed people. There's an interesting book on this very topic by Gary Hart, our people, called The Minuteman, which advocates cutting the U.S. military by 2/3 and having the rest of it being just prepared to defend the U.S. population and have a population where people are trained to defend themselves, a militia, and things are capable, in a way, turning the whole country into a kind of, where necessary, into a kind of national guard, but not when you send overseas, but at all. the people are trained and have the military capacity until, as you say, the whole world has changed, and I take that quite seriously. But certainly it's been the tradition of the anarchist movement going back before the French Revolution, back to the American Revolution, up through the socialist movement, then up through anarchism to lead in the militia, some kind of democratic. And we know, again, we know that the guerrilla struggles have sometimes been defeated, but sometimes succeeded. That's a possibility, at least. Some kind of popular decentralized military force were capable of defending people against the foreigners. And the main thing, after all, would be political. And you can say, selling people to other countries, we have given, got rid of our military government. We have got rid of nuclear arms. We think I use nuclear arms for popular position. We have stopped threatening to exterminate you. Don't let your governments come in and attack us. If you do, we'll have to defend ourselves. If you do, we will try to win over your armies to come onto our side, our political forces. And I think it's not enormous. If the United States had a revolution, socialist, communist, anarchist, whatever you call it, I bet I pulled the plug in the bathroom. This is the center of the world imperialist system. You really think of the likelihood that we're going to be attacked by other countries is conceivable, but frankly, it needs the whole world going up in flames, I hope. And that answers the question. All right, does someone want to respond before now? Do you want to speak again? Okay, yeah, yes.
I think with the subject of protection, the question of like what you would be protecting would be relevant. Like it seems like many people when they talk about it, they're still thinking of like a national identity, how do we protect America? But you can just as easily still consider yourself as occupied by what would be the American government or just corporations in general, and that you're, it's more of a question of identity. How are we already protecting ourselves against, because if we decentralize the, you know, on the continent of geographic America and these other nation states come in, you know, you as an individual have to think about how you're individually going to protect yourself if you can form these federations. But I think you, it's a broader subject about what is being protected, you know, your life or your identity in a larger view.
Back there, yes.
Do you, any or all of you, view the aspirations of anarchism ending up in a situation where, the geographic separations of people continue to be an axis of strife between differently located anarchist, not governments, but entities? I mean, would you see the anarchist United States and the anarchist Europe coming into conflict over fishing in the Atlantic in sort of traditional ways?
Anybody want to shout at that? Yes?
I think, like, what would happen is there would be, like, a federation of an anarchist Europe and an anarchist North America. And that would be a forum to work out any kind of differences that probably would arise between different regions in a democratic, peaceful manner. And underpinning all this has to be like a conception of like being a central principle, not resorting to the horrible violence that occurred in the 20th century as a means of solving problems. I mean, yeah, different regions might have different interests at times, but it has to be underpinned by a feeling of solidarity and mutual aid, and of discussing these things in a democratic forum, and also of having a decentralized method for uniting all people in the world to have a forum to work out anything like that. At least that's how I would say it.
Over there, yes?
Yeah, just this topic of decentralization, like you said, centralized versus decentralized. You mentioned earlier that there have been decentralized forces that beat centralized forces. I don't think that's true. I think there's been decentralized, more recently, I'm not talking about like in ancient times. People or decentralized forces have been able to hold off centralized forces, but not necessarily beat them. I mean, Vietnam so-called beat AmeriCorps. No, they didn't beat anyone. They just were able to stop America from necessarily taking over their country. And you have places like Iraq or places like that people, like you just said, that they're fighting off the Americans pretty well. Actually, they toppled the government and they instituted their own government. That's just the the militia or whatever you want to call it, Hezbollah, still fighting against the American government, but that has nothing to do with the actual government of that country. That'll pretty soon go down. I mean, that'll go down in history as an American win, more than likely. And as far as you said that, you know, colored people are starting to join these groups here, I don't see that either. I see them separating themselves and creating their own groups because they see a sort of rejection in these type of groups and an aversion towards their leadership. I don't think it's a coincidence that there's no black people on that panel or there's no black people on any panel that I go to unless they're a front or a token that they put on the panel for their own benefit. I mean, blacks can speak about communism or anarchism just as good as anyone else. So it's not like there's no black people that can do that. I mean, I think it's a sort of a consensus that people have naturally to want to see their own, even if it's not like sort of, what's what I'm looking for? Conscious, you know, to see people of their own group, you know, representing the majority of people. Just one last thing, because I don't want to like exasperate, but. And as far as like Americans being majority white, so that's the reasons why anarchist groups are majority white. I don't think that has anything to do with anything. I think the group that should comprise the most people should be the group that's most oppressed, not the group that just randomly wants to be a part or wants to be the majority of the group. So, and the most oppressed people are obviously not white kids who more than likely come from well-to-do families who just want to rebel and then 10 years later become conservatives.
Oh. Let me say that I agree with you, especially with the last comment. And I certainly, that's the sign of the success of anarchism will be when it reaches down into the very most oppressed. You're right, it's a problem. Now when, as it's happening, the very slow, it's there, people of color become anarchists. Some join groups that are mostly white. Some form their own groups. I'm perfectly open. Okay with me, whatever they do. You want to form all black anarchist groups, as long as you're willing to work together. You know, I have no principle saying, I'm absolutely big, or if you want to join a group that's integrated, but you want to have a black caucus, that's also okay. You know, we're open. It's not like there's a principle, you've got to join the centralized party. We're not building that centralized part, you know. That's part of being an anarchist. So we're perfectly open on those bases. The point about essentialism and fights is a long discussion. Basically, I say, guerrilla forces have made it difficult for an imperialist force to keep hold on. Sometimes it's been a defeat to the imperialist forces. Essentially, the United States was defeated in Vietnam. The Soviet Union was defeated in Afghanistan. In fact, that's totally the basis of the whole crackdown was its defeat in Afghanistan by these sort of tribal type people. The United States is being held off right now by fairly decentralized groupings. But there's no guarantee. We're talking about could the United States, not a small little country dominated and attacked by another major imperialist force. The question that would be raised before was if the United States was more decentralized, could North America organize itself in such a way that it could defend itself against foreign imperialists? And I believe it probably could. I'm going to guarantee. Especially since part of the argument is not the military force, but the political influence. Our ability to win over the soldiers, our ability to make it hard for other countries to invade, and so forth and so on. Part of the reason the Vietnamese won was because of the anti-war movement in this country. Part of the reason that the United States may have to leave Iraq is because the American population getting fed up. You can't, you know, hard to count on that. So I agree with a lot of what you're saying. And the other one, we'll just have to see. Yes. Stand up, please. And speak loud.
A lot of people have an aversion to joining these groups because they don't feel as though they can get to the positions that they want to get to, because historically there has been an aversion. I mean, you look through papers, like with the SDS, they're split from many black groups, but for the same causes, the same reasons, a racial conflict that they had. Blacks wanted to be in a certain position, whites going, oh no, you can't take over this group, that's not going to happen here. So, I mean, that's been documented, well documented. It's also, I think, it's a farce to say that you can just group people together and despite their gender differences or racial differences, that they're just going to come and just like, you know, come together with peace. That's I don't think that's going to happen. History shows that that's not going to happen. And that, not to make this a racial issue, but asking the question, I'm answering it. But I think history has shown itself that wherever a black person comes into a white group, the consensus mainly is that whites, especially if that person tries to take a leadership role, does not want that person around. And especially if that person or speaks heavily to the black cause, where they start to feel alienated because they start going, well, why is he not speaking about everybody? Why is he speaking about black people or whatever? So I think, to answer your question, I think to be more accepting, basically, and try to recruit more, maybe, even, you know, and you see where it goes from there. That's how I see it.
Yes. Yeah. I have a number of questions about space. I have a question about time, which is the time of transportation revolution. And about catastrophe and how that matters. You had a number of images of catastrophe, nuclear, environmental, that makes anarchism a necessity, right? Which then is a response, which is almost as cataclysmic revolution, sort of immediate transformation, or very quick temporal transformation. I guess I would wonder, I would ask, you know, about the task for the rest of the panelists too. Is this sort of figure in the UK or in Aragon in your situation, right? I mentioned certainly the green anarchists have a notion of collapse, at least. But when you talk about the total transformation of everyday life and society, in terms of the time of that, how that might work in this same kind of time for revolution.
Speaking about environmental collapse in the UK, it's never really figured as a real strong point in a lot of, especially anarcho and upper communist thought. But in terms of the Earth First movement and things like that, it's been obviously quite central. There's been an interesting change actually in the, maybe 10 years ago, most people thought we were on the up and, you know, environmental catastrophe was going to happen, but we've got this great movement, everyone's optimistic, we're going to change that. Over the last few years, I think that's changed, and a lot of people are like, well, oh shit, it's coming, can we beat it, or are we now just looking at survival after the collapse? And there's been a general shift in terms of the discourse over these sort of ideas. But it's not really played heavily in terms of anti-communism, in terms of a general fear that it's coming right now. It just hasn't really changed.
How do you see a revolution happening?
Well, I see a revolution coming from people from below, not from a response to a collapse, but maybe a response to economic situations and things like that. But I think in general, building up of alternative systems and alternative ways of organizing, and these that are, and that's what I think will actually bring about social change.
I'm generally very cagey about these sort of questions because I tend to feel as though the focus on, while I have a desire for a radical transformation of society, I actually think that theory about these sorts of changes are very, very weak. And our paramount argument about whether or not when the Martians come, whether green or blue. But if I were to not be cagey and to be a little bit more direct, about this particular question, I would look to the inspiration or to a reading of the 60 years prior to the Spanish Revolution and the multi-general transformation that happened in that 60-year period to the 1930s. Now, obviously, we know that the 1930s, while some may semantically call that the Spanish Revolution, really it was a situation that happened that ended up turning into something that we can now look back in time and say, that was the anarchist moment. And so it took 60 years of what would now be called a lifestyleist movement to come up with something that was another moment. And And I think for me, if I were to talk about what my practice actually is, it probably looks an awful lot more like that 60 years with maybe a little bit more of a sense of my eyes on the prize, and maybe I'm probing a little bit closer to these questions about theories of social transformation, but I think that's where I would go. I would talk about generational distances. Because I'm not enamored with collapsist arguments. I tend to find them to be more influenced by Christianity than they may let on. And so, that was not for me.
I would say I'd rather not believe that there were collapses ahead, but I'm afraid that there are. Now that even the bourgeois journals talk about global warming, issues of Time magazine, Newsweek, and so forth, and it's become part of the popular discourse, this is not some kind of secret that there are fundamental problems. You just look out the window and read the newspapers. While it's obvious that we are not on the verge of a revolution, it's also obvious that there are political crises developing, that things are not the same as they were, that there is both the growth of a far right wing, and that there's at the same time there's been just a little bit of a turn to the left among masses of people, the beginning of a new wave of radicalization. I don't expect really to see a revolution, but I do expect, in terms of probabilities, to see the rise of a major period of radicalization, something that would be even greater than the 60s. That would be so like a combination of the 60s and 30s, because it would include economic issues, because the post-war boom is over, even if it aren't. We haven't plunged into a new depression, but it's sort of like, instead of going, the economy is going, gradually downhill. I think we're faced with that. And I do believe in a revolution. I don't think of it as meaning that overnight all the problems will be solved. Quite the contrary. We may be beginning a whole new set of problems. I believe a long period of build-up, and I agree with Aragorn on this. A revolution does require a period of building up, including all sorts of changes and all sorts of movements. And then a moment of crisis, which includes a direct confrontation with those who hold power, and then a whole period afterwards of rebuilding and making sure the old don't come back and that you build a whole new society. All this is very drawn out, takes generations to do. But I believe there is a crisis and that there really is something that's worth committing ourselves to. It's not just a question of being a better person, it's also a question of looking forward to a different kind of life for the whole human race. That's the way I see it. I don't know, my comments on it. Time to wrap up. Does anyone want to make a last statement? Yes.
Well, I enjoyed the last comment you made about it being something where the individualism is involved. And that, in fact, I would like to have more of the center of what the discussion was about aspirations, not on revolution in society and destroying the evils that exist, but on the questions that have come from Socrates and Paul Whitman and continue comments about what would life be for each individual and the people that you were living with and the society and the structure that you were going to build to make every individual grow in a way and allow them to grow in a way that they should. But both things are involved in this. You have to have the revolution before you can have the growth of the society, which you did find.
I'd just like to say, for those who have been interested in the discussion on militias, the next person up here right now, fought in the Spanish Civil War in the militias there, so he'll be talking in a minute, so you might want to stick around and listen to that.
Thank you, everyone.